Hello world, I'm Josh Boykin, founder of IntelliGame.us and the host of the new IntelliGame podcast. Feels really good to say. Welcome to episode one, the inaugural edition. I am really excited to be here and finally launch the next step of this community for all of you. So thanks so much for checking this out. There's a lot of great content in store. IntelliGames existed in its web form since the end of last September, and I've enjoyed the discussions I've had with so many of you as a result. I created IntelliGame as a space where people could think and talk about games in a different context, not just as escapes or entertainment, but also a window into worlds outside and within. Games help me think more critically about my own actions and decisions in life, and they help give me insights about the people around me. So whether they're video games, tabletop games, or even just conventional sports, I think there's always something to learn from gaming. So I created IntelliGame to help share that love of knowledge and games with the world. To me, the IntelliGame podcast feels just like the next logical step. I've had a number of shows and appearances since I've launched IntelliGame. I've been on the Computer America show, Gamers Dominion, Spawn on Me, Metafilter's Best of the Web, Vertical Slice, and every time I've done a podcast or an appearance, I thought to myself, where's the IGPC? The IntelliGame podcast. Now, given the site's still in its infancy, but I've been writing professionally about games since 2009, and I've had the opportunity to meet some truly amazing people along the way. I'm looking forward to using the IGPC as a way to bring you some fantastic discussions about games and the culture around them. Now, let's not forget, I say I've written professionally in the world of gaming since 2009, but I've written in the world of gaming for far longer than that. I used to write choose-your-own-adventure books in elementary school, but using an old programming language called QBasic. I came up with plans to create my own expansions for the Star Wars card game that Decipher put together. I came up with my own Robot Masters to fight against Mega Man. I also tried to draw them, but that was part of when I realized I'm not a visual artist at all. I'm terrible at it. But still, I mean, I've written English reports to explicate love scenes between Cecil and Rosa in Final Fantasy IV, or Final Fantasy II, as it was when it was released here, but that's not really the point. The point is that I'm always looking for new opportunities to fuse my words into the world of gaming. And maybe from that respect, it's slightly selfish, but I'm okay with that. I hope you are too. Now, on to this week's episode. The main feature this week is an interview with Carol Mertz, founder of the one-person indie studio Insatiable Cycle. She's also the business development and community manager for Butterscotch Shenanigans, the studio behind Crashlands, an open-world crafting game that's turned heads since January of this year. I'm really excited to share our conversation with you as she talks about her work in the indie scene, games she's developed as a sort of personal catharsis, and recommends an IntelliGame for all of you. I'll also share an editor's cut of The Last Bastion, a reading of a piece I published last week, along with some extra content as well. And don't worry, I'll make a game recommendation of my own for you to check out. If you've got feedback about the show or just want to learn more, you can find it on Facebook at facebook.com/letsintelligame or on Twitter at twitter.com/letsintelligame. You can also email the show directly at podcast@intelligame.us. Now, let's go ahead and get started. Let's IntelliGame Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the interview section of the IntelliGame Podcast. I am really happy to have a pretty good friend of mine, an okay friend of mine. She's decent, but really happy to have a friend of mine here for our first IntelliGame Podcast interview. She has spent a lot of time trying to convince me to get this podcast started in the first place, so it only seemed altogether fitting and proper to have her on the show to get us started.
Yay!
Carol Mertz, welcome to the IntelliGame Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm super, super excited.
I'm super excited to have you on the show. It's really crazy to even think that we've come so far.
Right? We've come so far.
You and I met back in St. Louis, right? Mm-hmm. I believe probably the first time around was at the Pixel Pop Festival, right?
Yeah, the very first Pixel Pop was at 2014.
What led up to you being so involved in Pixel Pop? And then talk about Pixel Pop itself.
Cool. I started a interactive studio with some friends of mine back in 2010. And we started exploring games, which is how I got involved in the game industry. So we began making video games when we were a couple years into the web studio and just started making games in kind of whatever way we could. We didn't have any point of reference for how to start making games. And we decided that it would be really cool in St. Louis, where there aren't a lot of larger game studios, to host a festival or a game convention so that people like us who didn't have mentors and didn't have a lot of community connections could find that and could also come together and celebrate games, because we hadn't found any event that really encompassed that. So my business partner at the time, Ben, actually came up with the idea and pitched it to a friend of ours who organized a lot of anime conventions and really neat costume conventions and things in St. Louis. So he's really good at what he did.
True.
And he heard about the game convention idea and was stoked, super excited, and was like, yes, we're going to do this. And so 2014 was the very first ever Pixel Pop Festival. And it was just, the idea was just to create a space, a safe and interesting space to celebrate games and game development, and originally also music for games. Eventually, we cut the music aspect because it was less popular than just focusing on play and game development and kind of the culture of games. But it's grown since then, and we are about to start our third year, and we're going to be hosting it at the St. Louis Science Center this year, and we're super excited to see where it goes.
That's really cool. I mean, I've always been really impressed by Pixel Pop's attention to the little things. You know, I've gone to a number of larger scale conventions, but there's a lot of heart that you find in kind of those smaller conventions and abilities to meet people and have in-person, in-depth conversations with them in ways that you can't necessarily when you're running around the show floor on E3 or something like that.
The idea was absolutely to make it as empowering as possible for people who were coming in fresh, because that's the culture. That's the game culture in St. Louis, is not having a lot of background and not having a lot of access to mentors and education. And so the idea was to say, even if you're just starting out, even if you feel like you're a nobody, you're somebody here.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I hope that we've been able to create a space that reflects that.
I've played some really fantastic games at Pixel Pop that turned out to be larger scale releases, right? Cards and Castles, I first played it at Pixel Pop. Hive Jump is still on its way. It's
early access now.
It's really interesting and really awesome to see the St. Louis community kind of galvanized around events like that.
Pixel Pop this year, 2016, is happening October 8th and 9th at the St. Louis Science Center. I don't know when this podcast is going to go live, but applications to speak and demo games have been extended through August 31st.
Okay.
So if you're interested, there's still a couple of days left to apply. Otherwise, you can cut this section entirely.
Listeners, you should have approximately 24 to 48 hours. I hope I'm not putting my mouth on that one. Definitely applications for speakers are open. I've put mine in.
Yeah.
So, you know, with any luck, you'll be seeing or maybe hearing an episode of the IG podcast coming straight to you from Pixel Pop. You are involved in a lot of ways in the St. Louis game development community, whether it used to be through the IGDA or some other involvements that have taken place. Tell us a bit about the other ways that you've been involved in game development in St. Louis.
Yeah, in St. Louis, we used to not have any real sturdy community. There was a smaller meetup community that started with a game jam, actually, I think in 2010.
Okay.
But I hadn't even heard about it until I think 2011 or 2012. That was when we started making games, actually. And we decided to get together with some of the other game developers in the city and form a professional organization, a professional community. And that was the IGDA at the time, which is the International Game Developers Association. Mm-hmm. And eventually we just kind of decided to make it completely locally run and locally driven so that we had total control over the community and what the community was for and how we used our resources. And sure. So we transitioned that into what we have dubbed the St. Louis Game Developer Co-op, in reference to, you know, co-op gameplay and also kind of, you know, the co-op mindset of just working in the same space on the same stuff.
Yeah.
So that's been going strong for a couple of years now. And I've helped to not only set that up, but also organize a lot of the monthly events, get the culture in place, really try to make it as open and welcoming of a space as possible. And it's been a challenge, but it's also been really rewarding to see so many new creators find their own and become comfortable and excited and feel supported. It's just been a really cool experience to see a community thrive.
One of the things I remember you even telling me back in 2014 is that the St. Louis community has this way of interacting with each other that's really friendly. You don't have the rivalries that build up. It feels very Midwest, essentially, you know, as somebody from the Midwest. It feels very friendly. People are trying to help each other. And sure, you know, you can have your issues that arise here and there. But more often than not, it sounds like co-op is the right term for it.
Yeah. And to be honest, I've found that same feel throughout the indie community throughout the world. Almost every indie developer that I've met is just as supportive and just as encouraging and kind and collaborative and cooperative as the people in St. Louis. So I think it's something that's really unique to indie games in that it is very new of an industry and a space. And I think we all understand how hard it is to be here and how hard it is to be taken seriously and to create something good. And so instead of trying to compete with one another, we understand that we're all better off as a stronger single unit of cooperative, collaborative people and creators. So
that's really awesome. This is actually a good time to talk a little bit about your involvement with a couple indie studios. You started with the studio that you've talked about a little bit, kind of alluded to that you co-founded. And then since then, you've moved on to some other projects. Mm-hmm. So
the studio that I mentioned that I co-founded was Rampant Interactive, and we spun off a game studio called Happy Badger Studio. I was with them for 6 years and helped to build it, and we made probably over a dozen games total, mostly mobile, a lot of just kind of experimental self-teaching kind of projects because, like I said, we didn't have any frame of reference. We didn't have experience in the professional industry. The games that we made were kind of our way of going through game school,
sure.
Which I think is a really great way of doing it, honestly. But I left earlier this year to kind of pursue different opportunities. I started in my interim between jobs, I started my own little studio to sort of envelope the personal games that I create on my own, which are not really profitable, and I don't intend them to be profitable. They're sort of a creative expression medium for me. But that studio is called Insatiable Cycle, and I haven't really done much with it yet, but the idea is that it's kind of based on the idea of the Ouroboros, the snake eating its own tail, and the idea that my creativity, at least, is fed by itself. So with every ending comes a new beginning. That was where that came from. And then I have since joined the St. Louis game studio Butterscotch Shenanigans as their PR, marketing, and front-end web developer.
Has Butterscotch Shenanigans integrated you into their opening theme yet? Is there a fourth part for the harmony?
Not yet. We haven't recorded the harmony. So all of the Butterscotch Shenanigans games start with a little jingle that's Butterscotch Shenanigans. And the founders, who are three brothers, all harmonized with each other to sing that song. Actually, I think it's only two of the brothers who are singing and the third one is just faked in. Little known fact. Maybe I shouldn't have shared that on air.
Spoiler alert.
Spoilers.
You heard it first here on the Intel Game.
Yeah. But I know that we want to re-record it. I think it would be a lot of fun. I am, my face is on the latest release of Crashlands, their latest game. So if you start up the newest build of Crashlands, you'll see my blue glasses and long hair grace the logo screen.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I've played a bit of Crashlands myself. As somebody who's not big into crafting games, I still really enjoy it. It's got a lot of wacky, kind of zany humor to it. And of course, the backstory behind Crashlands and the Butterscotch Brothers developing it through some really serious adversity is a inspiring story.
Yeah. I started working with the studio well after Crashlands was released. It released in January of this year, and I started working there in June. But I've been friends with the guys for a few years now. And one of the brothers was actually diagnosed with lymphoma, probably, I think that was 2.5 years ago. And they were in the middle of development on one game, and he decided that if ever there was a time to shift gears and focus on making the game that means something to the world, that was the time. And so that was when they came up with Crashlands as a means for him to have something to focus on while he was undergoing treatment, and also give the world a place to escape into if ever they felt that they were going through something that was too difficult to handle on their own. And I think it's worked really well. It's a really, really fun story with a lot of those sort of deeper, darker allusions to pain and loss and just undergoing a lot of difficult times, essentially. So it's a three-act story, and the second act is especially interesting. But yeah, it's a fantastic game. I put 50 hours into it. And it's a really fun experience. It's not a sad experience at all. It's joyful and hilarious and, like you said, zany and absurdist and just so classically game and a lot of fun to play. I love it for so many reasons.
I'm glad that you have been able to hook up with a new outfit that is allowing you to explore some new creative ideas. And I also know the folks who are still back at Happy Badgers, and they're some really great people too. And
they're fantastic folks.
Yeah, you've had a lot of really good opportunities, and the ways that you've talked about creating, that they created Crashlands as a game that is meant to kind of mean something both to the world at large, but also to themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, that seems like a process that resonates with the way that you've approached your own independent game development, which is something that I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about. So on one hand, you have Butterscotch, and then on the other hand, you have Insatiable Cycle. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are a couple projects that I guess I would consider under the Insatiable Cycle umbrella, even though they came to life before Insatiable Cycle did.
Yeah, I would consider them the same. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would love to start talking about, first off, Pass the Buck.
Yeah.
A game of corporate responsibility management.
Right? Yeah.
So this isn't a video game. This is a card game, and it's a bluffing game where basically, I mean, anybody who's been in a boardroom or a project management meeting can relate to what happens in this game. How did you come about creating the game?
The game is, it's like it sounds, Pass the Buck, a game of corporate responsibility management. The idea is that you're throwing off all of your tasks onto your coworkers so that you have to do as little as possible and you can eventually level up and get promotions and eventually ultimately become the CEO. And the idea came from back when I was with my old studio. We worked with a lot of corporate clients, and it was one of the most frustrating situations that I had experienced up until that point, was just communicating with people who were so immersed in the corporate culture. The idea that I send an email about something that should be very simple, and I get the response, that's not my job, that's this person's job. That's not my job, that's this person's job. I've CC'd this person so that they can deal with it and I don't.
Yep.
This was happening time after time after time. And I was like, if I don't turn this into a game mechanic, it's gonna haunt me. It's gonna be sad, and I can't laugh at it, and I can't play with it, and it's not going to be something that I can find light out of unless I can convert it into something creatively satisfying. And so I actually wound up making a joke on my Facebook page that I'm gonna make a game called Pass the Buck, a game of corporate responsibility management. And by 2 days later, I had written a couple of pages of rules and started prototyping the game. And I decided to make it a card game because at the time I'd been playing a lot of Werewolf and Love Letter and Coup, all of which were really great, really elegant bluffing games that required human interaction. And that was what really drew me to them, was that you had to look people in the eye and lie to them, or look people in the eye and beg them to believe you because you were telling the truth and you knew you were, but they didn't believe you. And it was such an incredible feeling to me that I wanted to capture that with my own game. And so I decided to turn it, naturally also because of the theme, but I decided to turn it into a bluffing game. Mm-hmm. And it wound up working really well. I iterated on the prototype for a couple of years and then kickstarted it, which funded production. And I was able to manufacture a run of the card game. And
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And I released it on Amazon earlier this year and took it to E3, actually through IndieCade at E3. I was invited by the IndieCade Festival to bring it out and got to show it off. And it's been a cathartic and interesting experience to create a card game that so many people can identify with. When they hear the name, they assume it's either going to be hilarious or that they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Right. it ties me so much back to my project management and healthcare IT days, where I swear if I were to hand that off to practically anybody I was working with, they would be like, this is the game that encapsulates a small portion of my life.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, it's, even when it's a stressful part of that life, it is so funny to go through and use these cards that are tasks that you've put together to hand off to people, are things that are completely inane and yet sound like something somebody would try to hand off to you. Like, I'm going to need you to produce a viral video. It's like, that's not how that works. That's
right.
I still need you to do it, and I need you to do it by Monday. Yep. I think that's in your wheelhouse. You can handle that, right? You know, it very much feels IT or tech focused, which is a little more your background, but it applies the core concepts, reach into something that's deeper than references to development crunch cycles or general tech references. It's about an experience that we've all had to deal with, and creating that sort of catharsis of, I'm really frustrated right now, but I can see the humor and the laughter in it.
Yeah, the idea is that it satirizes and points out all of everything that's wrong with corporate culture and corporate America and the expectations thereof. And it's meant to be, it's funny because it's true, and also ridiculous because it's so close to true. All of the jokes, I mean, every single task is essentially a joke. And so there's about 90 jokes in the game, and every single one was inspired by something that has happened in some capacity. Right. And so it's always hilarious seeing people's reactions to tasks that they specifically identify most with, because the goal was to have it be diverse enough that somebody could identify with something, or anybody could identify with something rather. And from what I've seen, that's been pretty effective. I love making fun of shit. Like, am I allowed to say that on this show, by the way?
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, if you weren't, it's too late now. You've said
you
it.
You could beat me. I don't know.
I don't know if I have the technology to beat you out.
Just record a clip of you going beep.
Beep. Humor is such a big part of who you are and the way that you look at life. And that said, to me, one of your most influential projects is I Want You. It's a small game jam game and really doesn't tie a whole lot of humor into the experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I Want You was one of those games that I had to make. I think a lot of other artists could probably identify with the idea of having to create or feeling driven to make something to get out an emotion that you're having. And I was going through a lot of kind of inner emotional turmoil at the time and felt the need to explore that problem and explore those feelings through the best means that I knew how, which is interactive play. And so the Global Game Jam was coming up, and I knew that I wanted to explore some concept of what I was feeling. When the theme was announced as being ritual, I just decided to work on a team by myself, but incorporate other people into the project. And so what I did was I asked a bunch of other game jam folks to record a few lines for me and write down a few sentences for me without any context. And so the humor that's incorporated into the game came without any sort of context. It was all from the people who I was recording. But ultimately, the game is about feeling completely out of control of your own identity and not knowing who you are in light of everyone's expectations of you. And so what I'd ask people to record is them saying, I want you to be X. And so there were, I want you to be tender. I want you to be funny. I want you to be the kind of person who buys me pizza. I want you to be a golden retriever, not the kind in movies, but a real dog, a real loyal dog. And so there is humor, but it's also in this very dark, desaturized context of raw emotion. And that's kind of like, if you could peel me open and see inside me, that's what would be there, is humor mixed in with humanity and kind of this semi-darkness, which I think is where a lot of humor comes from ultimately. So I actually recently saw Vice's video that they released about Zoe Quinn, and she said something very similar, and it resonated a lot that, you know, it's kind of hard to find humor separated from darkness because a lot of times one feeds the other.
Absolutely.
So that was where I Want You came into play. And that one is available to play for free on my itch.io page. And I still sometimes go back and play it, and I still feel like, wow, I can't believe I made this.
I will post links to any of the projects or games that we have mentioned over the course of the cast. I'll make sure you have ways to find them, including the games on Carol's page.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah. We're starting to come up on time.
Okay.
I think I'm going to ask this of all of my guests. I've asked this question of 0% of my guests currently,
oh, no.
But by the end of this show, I will have asked 100% of my guests this question.
Goodness. That's a lot of pressure.
No pressure, but all the pressure. Yes. Mm-hmm. So at IntelliGame, the goal is to try and find ways to help people find games or game experiences that are influential, that are important, to find a way to use games as a lens to look at life. And I think we all have our own IntelliGames, our own games that make us think more deeply about ourselves or about the people around us or a particular experience. So if you had to recommend your IntelliGame, whether it's of the week, of the month, or overall, what would be your IntelliGame?
I have a lot because I love games.
How can you not, right?
Well, I love some games, I should say.
Yeah, that's true. We've had discussions.
Yeah. For this purpose, I'm going to share a game that I think reflects that darkness and humor. It was also the first game that I can remember actually crying while I played, the way that I would cry during a novel. Gone Home was a game that I played by myself from start to finish in one sitting and really changed the way that I felt about what games could be. For those who aren't familiar, you should become familiar, but Gone Home is essentially a game about a girl coming home to her parents' house after being away abroad at college, and she finds the home empty. And so the game is you playing this girl, exploring the home to try to find out where your family went. You start learning a lot about yourself and your parents and your sister. It really puts you in that position. It really is that experiential feeling that kind of transforms who you are into this girl. And there's lighthearted humor in places, even though there's not a lot of human interaction. There's, you know, letters and there's recordings and there's stories that really capture humanity in such a way that a lot of games fall a little short on for me. Like I said, the conclusion and the process all kind of added up to give me a really emotional experience. And it's something that I think I'll take with me, you know, every time I think about games that affect me and have affected the way that I feel about them. That was really one of the first ones that sort of opened me up to this world of experiential play.
That's beautiful. Gone Home and a number of other games that I feel like we see increasingly in the indie space. they're not what many people would conventionally consider games. They don't have a score. They don't have combat. They're very narrative focused. They're very much experiential titles. But there's a lot of value in the stories that come from those games. And I very much agree. 100% of recommended IntelliGames are good ones. So
excellent. I'm glad to hear it. And it's available for PC and it's been released on console now too. So if you're a console player and you didn't get a chance to play it on PC before, I definitely recommend picking it up and spending some time in the dark on the couch playing through.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for being the first guest here on the show. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you, both as a friend and as a guest.
Thanks, Josh.
Yeah. Thanks, dude.
I'm happy to be here. I'm so glad you invited me on the show.
Hopefully we'll have you back again real soon.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Carol for appearing on the first IntelliGame podcast. You can find Carol on Twitter at Carol Mertz, and you can find her work at carolmertz.com. Pass the Buck, a game of corporate responsibility management, is available on Amazon. It's also hilarious. And you can find many of her short game projects online at carolmertz.itch.io. Also, Butterscotch Shenanigans Crashlands is available on Windows, Mac, iOS, and Android. Head over to crashlands.net to learn more. All right, so this is the part of the show where I'm going to give a reading of a piece that we've published in IntelliGame in the past. Think of it as sort of a director's cut or special features edition of the article that you may have already read on the site. Now, I'll totally admit I am taking a nod from Dave Zirin's Edge of Sports podcast. He's the sports writer for The Nation magazine, and if you haven't checked that podcast out, I totally recommend it. And you're probably thinking, why would I listen to a sports podcast? He talks about all the things that are connected to sports that are really important to the world around us. For example, a few weeks ago, he was down in Rio and was talking about the favelas that had been displaced and a number of the other situations that we might not be seeing while we're watching all the people in their Olympic fanfare and glory. So thanks to Dave, and here we go. Why is The Last Bastion stuck in eternal death matches? Many game universes include stories that aren't considered canon, but what happens when those stories directly oppose the canon universe? The stories in games can reach just as far into our souls as books, movies, music, and TV shows. We expect these kinds of experiences in photorealistic thrillers like The Last of Us, or playing games based on established franchises like The Walking Dead. But the short films coming out of Activision Blizzard's multiplayer shooter Overwatch show that deep characters and introspection can come from games of any kind. Their most recent short, The Last Bastion, tackles themes of post-traumatic stress while detailing the backstory of Bastion, a sentient sentry turret presented with a choice between peace and war. It's a gripping short and tells a great story born from the Overwatch universe, but it also begs questions about a game's responsibility to its own lore. Now, this is the part where I would recommend that you check out the actual short itself. It is available on YouTube. If you go to Play Overwatch, the YouTube channel, you'll see all of the shorts listed there. The Last Bastion tells the story of Bastion E-54 as it awakens in a forest years after falling dormant. The war between humanity and sentient robots called Omnix in the Omnic Crisis is over, but it's still in recent memory for many. Now disconnected from the network that provided its programming, Bastion explores the natural world for clues about its own existence. It even befriends a passing bird and embarks on a near Snow White level forest journey, until the sound of a woodpecker in the distance reactivates the Bastion's old defensive protocols, with devastating effects. Now, The Last Bastion is a story of a robot trying to find itself in a world no longer the way it left it, but it reaches beyond the game and into the effects of trauma and triggers. Sure, Bastion is happy in the forest and isolated from war, but even the innocent pecking of a woodpecker unexpectedly submerges Bastion back into its trauma. It runs from the forest because, even though it values the space, it can't trust itself to be there without hurting what it cares about. These are some of the consequences of post-traumatic stress disorder in reality, a condition we generally think of for war-torn veterans struggling to reintegrate with society, but reaches much further than just those who've been on the battlefield. The struggle to overcome pains from our past is something we all identify with, even without PTSD, which is part of what makes this short so powerful. It's what makes all the Overwatch shorts so powerful. Though they're full of nods to the game for seasoned players, they're first and foremost stories about our own cores, telling tales in ways such that even people oblivious to Overwatch could still appreciate them. I'm just not sure how to appreciate The Last Bastion in particular when I'm not oblivious to the game. Truth be told, I've started playing Overwatch again since The Last Bastion's release, which I'm sure was part of the game team's plan. Watching the short reignited my interest in the franchise and got me to play a match, which got me to play another match, and so on. Still, there's something that feels wrong about the idea of learning that a character has war-induced PTSD, then subjecting it to kill after kill after death after kill. So, slight side note, those who are reading this and are really into the mechanics and implications of this sentence may think that I just implied that my KDR, or kill-death ratio in the game, is 3-1, that I would get 3 kills for every 1 death. Those who have actually played Overwatch with me know this is not the case. Overwatch's gameplay doesn't technically exist in the same realm as the lore. Much like League of Legends and other multiplayer-focused titles, the multiplayer combat isn't considered canonical and exists in a bubble separate from the developing story. Still, does it make sense as a creator of a game universe to take even just an avatar of a character trying to recover from the traumas of war, and then subject it to a life of eternal war? I love The Last Bastion and all the other Overwatch shorts as prime examples of the stories that can come out of the world of video games, but this feels too much like a case of Overwatch having its cake and eating it too. By the end of the short, Bastion E54 is left with a choice. Return to its old programming and seek war, or move on to a new and different life in the forest. Bastion chooses the forest, which doesn't really create a space where it then enters into multiple escort and territory capture missions, gunning down the opposition in the world of multiplayer. The other Overwatch films provide justification for each character's participation in combat, at least subtly reinforcing the possibility of the haphazard roughhousing in the core game. Bastion's tale, on the other hand, works directly against it. Each of the Overwatch short films feels like a mini Pixar movie. Bite-sized flicks made to hit as hard as Toy Story or Inside Out. Pixar's messages, however, and Disney's for that matter, profit by reinforcing their universes. Theme park attractions immerse attendees in the worlds of each intellectual property, creating a continuity between the participants' experience and the world that they explore. Disney and Pixar video games do the same, creating new experiences within each IP, but adhering to the rules set by each universe. I should note here that I actually used to work for Disney, and I had an opportunity to talk to some of the folks who were working at the time for Disney Interactive Media Group, the arm of the company that was responsible for putting together games such as Disney's The Lion King, Disney's Aladdin, Disney's Toy Story, and also Epic Mickey, but I'm thinking specifically of the tough-as-nails platformers that I grew up on in the Super Nintendo era. And the interesting thing is that when you play each of those games, they may interact with certain key points in the structure of those particular movies, but they don't just follow the movie from tip to tail. They go off in their own directions and reinforce the universe that's present in the movies. So you almost feel like you've picked up extra chapters in a book or been given sort of a hint or inside story that details this universe. And I think that there's something so powerful about being able to delve deeper into the universe and feeling like it's one cohesive unit, as opposed to saying, well, this part of the universe exists over here, and this part of the universe exists over here, and that thing doesn't really exist, and that thing kind of exists, but only if Frank Miller talks about it. The player's experience within the gameplay of Overwatch, on the other hand, directly contradicts the rules set up in the animated shorts. No matter how many times your character dies, it'll get back up and keep fighting. This combat leaves no scars mentally or physically, and the character's beliefs and goals won't prevent them from working alongside any other character, no matter how good or bad either of those characters are. Overwatch provides no opportunity for players to immerse themselves in a world where the Omnic Crisis is anything more than an inside joke for devoted players, where Tracer and Widowmaker's rivalry is anything more than just window dressing, or where Hanzo's brotherhood with Genji leads him to either his own redemption or demise. If any of the characters I just referenced are unfamiliar to you, I recommend going over to the Play Overwatch YouTube channel and checking out the shorts Alive and Dragons. Those two in particular really show the ways that they've delved into these characters and established heart, even though they're just in what would feel like a standard issue multiplayer shooter. With so many players who find value in the themes set by those conflicts, and with Blizzard setting those themes front and center with each film, it seems all the worse that those themes vanish in the actual game. I love Overwatch and the characters and world it brings to the table, but it feels somehow unfair that it tugs at my heartstrings with stories of trauma and potential loss, then tugs at my pocketbook and my energy with hours of repeated killing and death. This isn't an ask to make all canon game stories correlate directly with their gameplay, but asking players to live in a realm of direct contradiction feels irresponsible. The Last Bastion is a great piece of cinema, but it feels sad we tell a story where Bastion returns to a forest of peace, then still trap it in a world of war. On each episode of the IntelliGame podcast, I'm going to call out an IntelliGame of the week. Whether it creates a platform for discussion, evokes feeling, or is simply just really good in its terms of gameplay or experience, I think there are games of all kinds out there worth talking about. And this week's game is actually one that I've avoided talking about ever since I launched IntelliGame, but I think now's the time. I haven't talked much about Life is Strange on IntelliGame, even though most people who know me know I'd consider it my game of the year for 2015. Honestly, I just love the game so much that I'm always afraid that I'm going to somehow do it a disservice when I talk about it. It was the only game last year that actually made me jump out of bed when I groggily read an email at 4 a.m. telling me that the conclusion released. I couldn't think of anything other than getting it downloaded onto my computer as soon as possible. Life is Strange is a narrative-driven, five-part episodic story about friendship, growing up, and the effects the decisions we make have on the world around us. Or not. In Life is Strange, you play as Max Caulfield, an 18-year-old girl returning to her hometown of Arcadia Bay. It's a sleepy town in Oregon, the kind most high schoolers dream nonstop of escaping. Max returns to Arcadia Bay after 5 years away, attending Blackwell Academy. Life in Arcadia Bay starts to change when Max discovers that she has the ability to rewind time. She finds out when she watches her old best friend, Chloe Price, be shot and killed in a high school bathroom by Nathan Prescott, a local trust fund baby with multiple issues. Life is Strange juggles multiple plots over its 5 episodes. Max and Chloe are working together to find a missing student named Rachel Amber, while also trying to prevent a catastrophic storm from destroying Arcadia Bay. It's a storm that only Max truly knows about because she's seen it and the devastation it causes, then rewound time to try and avert its tragedy. Over the course of the game, life presents Max with a number of choices, which you as the player will have to decide. Using Max's rewind power, you can see the potential consequences of each decision, and none of them are truly easy. I, like everyone else, have thought about moments in my life that I wish I could travel back in time to redo, but after playing Life is Strange, I learned how so many situations simply aren't clear-cut, and there's no way to guarantee a better outcome even if I could do it over. What makes Life is Strange such a powerful game, though, isn't just its butterfly effect-style rewind ability, nor is it the Twin Peaks-esque Where is Rachel Amber mystery. Life is Strange's power comes from its characters, so many of which feel like living, breathing people with backgrounds to explore and hearts of their own. Whether it's Kate Marsh, the quiet girl at school who's bullied for her religious beliefs, Victoria Price, the bully with vulnerabilities of her own, or Daniel, the artist who offers to draw Max once they get to know each other. The world of Arcadia Bay feels full of information and life. Even though all of these relationships take a back seat to the one that develops between Chloe and Max, Blackwell Academy and Arcadia Bay as a whole encourage exploration, both of the world of the game and the characters inside. Given, Life is Strange isn't a perfect game. Some characters feel flat, including a couple of their few characters of color, though as someone who lives in Oregon, I can attest to the idea that you might not see very many people of color in many circumstances. The story takes a pretty sharp turn between episodes 4 and 5 that I wasn't a big fan of, and there are some times that the game element of Life is Strange gets in the way of the story. There are cumbersome, somewhat awkward puzzles or pointless scavenging fetch quests, but the heart and soul of Life is Strange is undeniable, and its closing few decisions tug at the heartstrings in really meaningful ways. This isn't necessarily a kid's game, though. Potential gun violence, suicide, and sexual assault all come into play over the course of the story. but I still encourage you to check this game out, as it shows just a bit of the power of games to tell impactful, deep-reaching stories. Plus, the first episode of Life is Strange is available for free on console, PC, and mobile, so there's no reason to not at least give it a try. As a note, if you're not the type to typically play your own games, this is the kind that I would recommend watching a Let's Play video of. There are tons of Let's Plays on YouTube, and I'd recommend finding one either without commentator voiceover, or voiceover from a commentator who's taking the game seriously. Sure, there are some jokes to make in there, but the title as a whole is worth taking pretty seriously. Props to the folks over at Don't Nod Entertainment and Square Enix for putting together a fantastic IntelliGame. Find out more about it at lifeisstrange.com. Well, IntelliGamers, that does it for the first episode of the IntelliGame podcast. Thanks again to my special guest, Carol Mertz, and thanks to you for helping me break the champagne bottle on the good ship IGPC. I'm your host, Josh Boykin, and you can find me on Twitter at Wallstormer. Don't forget to stay up to date on IntelliGame on social media by looking for Let's IntelliGame on either Facebook or Twitter. And of course, keep checking IntelliGame.us for more editorials and posts. This week, I'll be attending my first Penny Arcade Expo. I'll be at PAX West in Seattle, Washington, and I'm excited to meet some great people there. So if you're going to be there, hit me up. Until next time, don't just game, IntelliGame.